Welcome to the new revolution in fitness and performance. The Ardella Training Podcast. Forging athletic bodies around the world. Here's your host, physical therapist and strength coach, Scott Ardella.
Hey guys, if you're looking for top-level strength and conditioning equipment and gear, my primary resource is Rogue Fitness. Rogue has exceptional quality kettlebells, bars, plates, sleds, conditioning equipment, home gym racks, apparel, and everything you need to train strong and get results. I've been recommending the kettlebells for a long time, but all the equipment and gear is top-notch. So if you're looking to add equipment or start building your home gym, Rogue is the place to go. Go to ardellatraining.com/rogue and check out all the great equipment, accessories, and apparel. Again, that's Ardella Training, R-D-E-L-L-A, training.com/rogue, R-O-G-U-E. All right, guys, welcome to episode number 115. Thanks for being here today, and I've got a great one for you this week. I have Brett Jones, who is the Chief Strong First Kettlebell Instructor. Brett is athletic trainer certified. He is a certified strength and conditioning specialist. He is on the advisory board and a lecturer for the functional movement screen, which we talk about in this interview. And he is the co-creator of multiple DVDs, some of my favorites, including Kettlebells from the Ground Up. So we had a great discussion this week, and here's some of the things that you're going to hear about. You're going to hear about the functional movement screen, the FMS, what it is, what it is not, common mistakes with the FMS. You're going to hear about specific exercises or progressions to address a common weak link. You're going to hear about an underutilized athletic tool to improve shoulder health. You're going to hear how Brett uses this tool in his own training. You're going to hear the product that he's most proud of. You're going to hear a lot of great insights and analogies that Brett always shares. I guarantee you're going to learn a lot in this session. You're going to hear about what makes a great coach and his great, awesome closing advice. I definitely recommend that you listen to the end of the show and hear what he has to say as he wraps up the interview. I think this is really, really great advice. So I want to make sure that you definitely don't miss that as well. So listen, before we get into the show, let me just remind you that this is your opportunity, if you like the Ardella Training Podcast, to win a free $50 gift card from Rogue Fitness, which is one of my favorite fitness equipment suppliers. So the contest started last week and it goes through the end of the day on April 22nd of 2015. I'm giving away three $50 gift cards for Rogue Fitness. Now, all you have to do is post a review in iTunes or Stitcher. If you're in iTunes, you simply go to, first of all, you find the Ardella Training Podcast in iTunes. Then you click on ratings and reviews, click on write a review, post a review, and then submit your review. And when it posts, send me the screenshot. Let me know which review is yours. Message me on Facebook or contact me through the ardellatraining.com website, and then I'll add your name to the list. Thank you so much if you've already done this. Reviews have been really, really great. And I've mentioned this for a long time, but the reviews really are important to help the show grow. So every review matters, and I really appreciate all your support with this show. So as a reminder also, only the reviews between April the 8th and April the 22nd will be included in this giveaway. I wanted to make it really fair and open just between those time periods. And then I'm going to randomly select three winners, and the three winners will be notified by me, and then you'll get your $50 gift card from Rogue Fitness. If you want to know more about how to submit a review, you can go to ardellatraining.com/review. Again, that's ardellatraining.com/review. And there's a little screen capture tutorial there that will tell you how to do it. And it's very easy to do in Stitcher as well. You just simply scroll down the page and you'll see something there on the right-hand side that says write a review, and you click on that, and it'll walk you through the process. Again, very, very simple. So again, Brett Jones is here today. Again, really, really good insight, as Brett always shares. If you've heard Brett before, he always has a way of describing things and relating them with specific analogies that just make things very simple to understand. So he shares a great insight in this session. I think you'll learn a lot. And we actually covered a lot of different topics this week. So with that, let's get started this week with the interview with Brett Jones. All right, guys, I've got a great session for you today as Brett Jones graciously returns to the podcast. So Brett, first of all, thank you so much for coming back and joining me this early morning.
Scott, absolutely welcome. Look forward to today's session, and always a pleasure to be on.
Excellent. Thank you. So before we get into the topics and my questions, I thought it'd be great if you could bring listeners up to date with what you're up to, kind of your new role and other projects that you have going on.
Absolutely. So the newest thing is that I have taken on the role of Chief SFG Instructor within Strong First. So I was at the second ever kettlebell certification that Pavel taught in February of 2002. I've been traveling and teaching with him since April of 2003. And now I've stepped into this role as the Chief SFG, where I'm helping to refine and develop curriculum for the SFG Level 1, Level 2, and the User course. And working with our masters, seniors, team leaders, and the leadership of SF Strong First, Pavel and Eric Frohart and others, to progress and grow that organization. So very excited about that opportunity. It's something that I've been passionate about for over a decade, and having the opportunity to really step in, have some ability to impact, really impact things, is very exciting for me.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're all excited about that, and we could certainly spend probably a whole session talking about your role and the vision for Strong First, but we will save that for another time for sure.
I look forward to coming back, or look forward to the chance to do that.
Absolutely. All right, so let's lead off here with the FMS, or Functional Movement Screen. Now, for those that are listening that aren't familiar with the FMS, I thought it'd be great if you could summarize what the screen is designed for and what it's not designed for.
Absolutely. Functional Movement Screen, part of Functional Movement Systems. The FMS is our entry point into Functional Movement Systems. So when we bring somebody in and screen them, we're very simply trying to set a movement baseline. It's really no more complicated than that. This movement baseline looks at how you move you. So it's a body weight relative or a body weight standard movement baseline. We're looking to see if you have any pain. We're looking to see if you have any movement issues or motor control issues that need to be addressed prior to getting more aggressive about your training, or catching things midstream if you're already training for something. And it's really, I mean, I'd love to go on and be flowery and scientific, but really it's that simple. We're trying to set a baseline for fundamental movement. We're trying to identify pain and restrictions, asymmetries, the dirty word dysfunctions, before they become an issue. It helps direct a training program. If you come in and you score a 1 on your deep squat, squats just came off of the exercise menu, as far as I'm concerned. I've just freed up a bunch of time in the rest of my program. And I know the screen will tell me where to direct my efforts from a corrective standpoint, but it also gives me information as to where not to go from a training standpoint. Now, as soon as I've got your squat up to a two, hey, squats are back on the menu. Let's get after it and start training that. I love squats.
Right.
So that's kind of it in a nutshell. What is it not designed for? It's not designed to be used on pain. If you walk into my studio or wherever I happen to be working with you, or hopefully wherever an FMS professional is screening you, and you come limping in or holding your shoulder, and you're already in pain, I'm not even going to do an FMS on you. That's where we bump to the medical model, the right. clinical model, the SFMA, and that's our movement model for looking at pain. Now, if you come in and you're pain free and you're ready to go, and we screen you and find out that your shoulder actually has an impingement sign, or your knee hurts during a split stance, asymmetrical stance, inline lunge. I need to find out why that pain's there. And that's not the FMS. The FMS threw up the red flag, let us know that the pain is there. But now I need to go into a different model and address that pain. It's also not, the FMS is not a performance measure. We see people all the time who are confused that really awesome athletes, people that get on a basketball court or a football field or whatever it happens to be, who are really killing it from a sports perspective, from a performance perspective, might not show up with the best FMS score. And that doesn't surprise me at all, because great athletes are great compensators. They got this neurological system that allows them to get the job done, even if there's a roadblock in the way. My job with an FMS is to find those roadblocks, open up more buffer zone, help that person move better.
Right. I think that's really, you made a couple of really good points there. Number one is that it's not a performance measure. So it's really important to understand that. And then number two is the point about pain, to make sure that if a person is in pain, that they move on to the next step in the process, and that is getting appropriate medical attention or moving on to the SFMA in the process.
Absolutely. We've reached a really interesting point in fitness and training. I think people expect to be in pain to a certain extent, and I think that's both sad and a problem. As I joke all the time, the only place fitness comes before health is in the dictionary. People really kind of misinterpret or have an issue with understanding that pain is not normal, and it doesn't matter how tough you are. I think that's the other thing people need to realize, because we admire the athlete who competes while injured. Maybe they get their hand, a football player gets their hand caught between two helmets, and there's some nasty little fractures in there, but they finish the game. They power through. The marathon runner who has a crack in her femur at mile 22, but finishes the marathon. We admire these people, and rightly so. I mean, yes. there's something very visceral about toughness and enduring and overcoming. That shouldn't be every day. That's not how we want you to train. You should not be in pain during a bench press. You should not have screaming knee pain during a squat. It's just not normal. It's not right. And it doesn't matter how tough you are and how much you can deal with it. Your body has other ideas. It will compensate around the pain. So addressing those things responsibly is the role of the fitness professional. You need to know where your swim lane is, stay in your swim lane, and find a group of professionals that you can work with and trust and help people appropriately address their pain.
Let me ask you this. So what about the workout warrior who is dealing with pain and they don't want to take time off? What's your specific guidance with that? How can someone maybe train at some level? What do you say
sure.
to that?
You can always dance around issues. But the tough thing is, I may have to ask you to stop your favorite activity for a little while.
Yes.
the joke I always make at workshops is, when was the last time you drove up to your mechanic's garage and said, "Hey, Bob, get in the car. I need you to fix it while I'm on my way to work." It just doesn't work. You're going to have to pull the car in the garage and let the mechanic do his or her thing and address that issue. So I may need you to not run for a couple of weeks. I may need you to not squat for a couple, 3 weeks. You know, I can't give any specific time frames. But there's other ways that I can give you a workout.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the people that think the correctives are always, you know, fluffy, feel-good exercises, you know, that's a misinterpretation of some of the drills that we use. And we can certainly, we can get you a workout in, but may have to pull the car in the garage.
I think that's an excellent point, is kind of the mindset of, you know, taking a step back, maybe even just for a few weeks, and getting to the root of the problem, and maybe realizing that you're going to resume that later, but you can't power through something that's really causing pain. I mean, that's the bottom line. So
it is, and it just seems to be a very hard message for people nowadays. They have an idea that I fully understand the idea of getting your identity through, or an activity being part of your identity, I should say. So you'll meet people who will identify themselves as a runner. "Hey, Grace, what do you do?" "I'm a runner." "Well, I actually meant your job, but cool, you're a runner. That's awesome."
Right.
But you know, a big part of my identity for a long time was strength.
Yes.
You know, I was bending nails and picking up heavy stuff. Actually, I was bending nails before it was cool, I guess. and that was really a big part of my identity. And I ran into a couple of things that made me have to step back from that. And you have those moments where you wish you had a direct line to Dr. Phil for a little bit of counseling for, you know, the challenge that you're going through. But, you know, stepping back and appropriately addressing those things will only allow you to hit higher peaks. You don't have to suffer in order to succeed.
Yes. Brett, are there any specific misinterpretations you've seen, maybe specific to scoring? I'm curious what your take is on reliability with the scoring with the FMS.
According to the research, inter and intra rater reliability is consistently good to very good to excellent within the research. So
yes.
If the scoring criteria, let me back up there for a second. If the setup is correct, meaning you understand the purpose and description of the screen you're getting ready to run, if you use the verbal instructions, and if you then make sure the setup is correct for every rep, and you appropriately apply the scoring criteria, the inter and intra rater reliability is very good with the FMS. So where I see people making mistakes is not making sure that the setup is perfect for every rep. There seems to be a blind spot between reps 1, 2, and 2 to 3, where somebody doing a deep squat, for example, might have their feet spin out, something of that nature. And then they don't reestablish the proper setup position for the next rep. And then all of a sudden the squat looks really good. Well, it's not because their squat got better. It's because you let them have a compensation because you didn't ensure that the setup position was correct for the next rep. So as long as the purpose and description, the verbal instructions, the setup is good for every rep, and the scoring criteria is appropriately applied, we look really good from an inter and intra rater reliability standpoint. And the mistakes I see people making typically is being too generous. I like to refer to threes as Bigfoot sightings, often reported, rarely verified.
Okay.
And if everybody you're screening is like, you know, "Wow, look at all the threes on the scorecard," you're probably being too generous in your scoring. You need to go back and hold to the setup, the verbal instructions, the scoring criteria. That's usually, from a scoring perspective, that's usually the biggest thing I see, is just way too generous. Okay. And it's not that you're being mean. I don't know. I think some people fear like being mean. And I don't discuss scores with the people that I'm screening. I think that's another thing that, either because somebody leaves an FMS workshop and they think they're speaking to a fellow movement screening professional,
right?
You know, this is Executive Joe. He just wants to golf better, or
yes,
you know, Grandma Betty wants to garden, or Grandma Betty wants to play squash better. Whatever it is. When I screen those individuals, I preset the expectations by saying, hey, we're going to go through this thing called the FMS. It's seven different movements. I'm going to give you some instructions and get you in position. I'm going to ask you to do this movement. Just follow the instructions. If you have any questions or you don't understand, you know, let me know right away. If anything hurts, let me know right away. And I'm not going to give you a whole lot of feedback as we're going through this thing, because I don't know anything till we're done with the whole thing.
Right.
So let's just go get it done. I don't sit there and have scoring discussions with people.
Sure.
At the end of it, when I've identified the weak link, I'm going to sit there and say, hey, you remember that thing you had trouble with? You know, raising your leg felt kind of tight. Yeah, let's go work on that.
Okay.
I don't get into this this scoring discussion, or, you know, you failed the screen discussion. My Lord, why on earth would you do that to somebody? But I think it happens, and it's just kind of, I think treating the person you're screening as a fellow movement screening professional is probably another misinterpretation or mistake.
That's excellent. Excellent advice. Now, I also wanted to ask you, in regards to the FMS, are there other assessment tools that you use in addition to the FMS?
Yeah, I mean, it really, now we're getting into some really interesting stuff, because if you're really running a needs analysis and you're really looking at what that person who's in front of you needs, I guess that's why they call it a needs analysis. It's clever.
That would make sense. Yeah.
if I have a clean FMS,
yes,
meaning all twos, no asymmetries or better, then I will likely go into something like a Y balance, a motor control test, to make sure that once we've cleared fundamental body weight movement, how's your motor control? There's an upper and a lower quarter test for that now, which is giving us some really interesting information. We've got like 25,000 Y balance tests collected. We've got Phil Plisky, Kyle Kiesel have done some amazing work there, and you'll be seeing some more on that in the next few months. Teaser. And remember the subliminal guy from Saturday Night Live?
Right.
Good
stuff.
I guess I just ruined it. I go next to the Y balance, and then it's really up in the air. What is Executive Joe, Grandma Betty, or Athlete Susie want to be better at? If the coach comes to me and says, Athlete Susie's a little slow getting back to the other end. Well, if fundamental movement is clear, motor control looks good, let's see if it's a strength or a power issue. And there's lots of different ways that we can look at that. So the FMS continues to be my entry point. But then beyond that, Y balance, if it's pain, it's SFMA. If it's performance, there's books written on performance testing, whether that's broad jump, vertical leap, med ball pass, different running tests and speed tests. There's lots of different ways to get that done. But what does the person need?
Yes.
Keep that in mind.
Is there a specific performance assessment book that you like? I'm just curious.
I would not hazard a guess on that.
Okay.
I have not, because I've been in general personal training for so long and haven't been an AT, active AT. I have my NATA cert back, but I haven't had to do that for an athlete in a long time, so I'm going to leave that in the hands of people. I know Gray and um, think Jeremy Boone had done on something on the hop and stop, and there's all of the measures that you can look at as far as T-test and beep test and things like that. I think Coach Boyle may have some more information on that in something like Functional Strength Coach. And then, that would be probably my biggest recommendations.
Okay. No problem. I didn't want to put you on the spot there, but I just thought I'd ask since you mentioned
it. Hey, I have selected my swim lane, and I stay within it. And would take me a day or two to get up to speed, but right now that's my best answer.
Got it. So shoulder asymmetry is a common finding with the FMS. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Should the goal be symmetry or to make progress? And I think it was actually you that said progress is progress, if I'm not mistaken.
I think better is better is my
is
my little mantra. And to kind of step back one step, when you run an FMS and you identify a weak link, and we within the level two workshop, the end of a level one workshop and the level two workshop, we really go over our scoring algorithm and how we address the FMS scores. And we do that in a very, we have an algorithm.
Yes.
We look at it in a very specific format. I'm going to look at your straight leg raise, shoulder mobility, rotator stability, trunk stability, inline lunge, hurdle step, deep squat, in that order. So if I look at your score sheet and I see a 1-2 active straight leg raise, I don't even look at any of the other scores. So if I see a 2-2 leg raise and I bump up one notch and I've got a 2-1 shoulder, boom, done. I know exactly what I need to work on. That's as far as my eyes go.
Right.
So when we find that 2-1 shoulder asymmetry and I start doing things to try to improve it, I just look for better. And the shoulder mobility is a great, it's an easy talking point within a podcast like this, because it's easy to say that somebody performed their shoulder mobility reach and they had a 8-inch hand, because I got to make numbers easy because I'm not really good with math. So the 8-inch hand, if I reach inside of 8 inches, I get a 3. If I reach between 8 and 12 inches, I get a 2. If I'm beyond 12 inches in my reach, I get a 1. So if I screen Executive Joe and he has a 9-inch reach on the right side and a 15-inch reach on the left side, I now have a 2-1 shoulder asymmetry. And if I can, you know, do something, and we'll probably get more specific on that here in a minute, but if I do some sort of thing, whether it's foam roller, breathing, corrective drill, whatever, and all of a sudden, Executive Joe is a 9-inch reach on one side and a 13-inch reach on the other, the score hasn't changed. He's still a 2-1 shoulder asymmetry, but I've gained 2 inches on that reach.
Right.
Better's better. I'll take that every day and twice on Sunday.
Absolutely. Now, are there exercises that you found that are typically most successful in improving shoulder asymmetry?
Absolutely. I think that got to go with breathing first. Breathing, the function of the diaphragm, the rib cage, intercostals, T spine, that interplay from with a breathing perspective is huge. And knowing that most people these days are just kind of chronic stress breathers, over breathing, I tend to see that breathing can be a very important piece of the puzzle for people. Beyond that, I start looking at I haven't stretched a shoulder in years. And I think that's maybe another misinterpretation within the FMS is, you know, for example, the shoulder mobility is called shoulder mobility. Well, duh. But but it's actually, yeah. Do you have the motor control? And I'm an air quotes guy, so if you can all visualize me doing air quotes right now, the core or motor control, how that plays together with the T-spine, the scapula, then the glenoid and upper limb. That sequence, so breathing helps make sure that I've got the diaphragm and rib cage doing the right thing. Then I'm going to go after some T-spine mobility. And we use our sideline rib grab typically as a beginning point because it's really easy to integrate the breathing into that position. And, you know, there's lots of different ways to increase T-spine mobility, from the sideline rib grab to a bretzel to a, you know, rotation with reach to quadruped versions. I mean, there's lots of different ways to do that. And then scapular stability. And so this isn't rows or anything like that. What I do for scapular stability typically is our torso rotation for scapular stability. And that may pop up on the FMS exercise library. I'm not sure. And then maybe I start worrying about what the glenoid is doing. Usually once I get the breathing, the T-spine, and the scapula doing the right things, lo and behold, the shoulder moves better.
Right.
The actual glenohumeral joint. So I worry, it sounds funny, but I worry very little about the glenohumeral joint. I worry about the stuff that helps it function well. And so we address it from that standpoint of almost coming from the center first.
Right.
And then I start worrying about the other stuff.
Yeah, so you're really addressing the entire shoulder complex, the entire upper body complex, really. Thoracic
yes.
spine, scapular region. What about cervical spine? Where does that relationship play into this?
Huge player. Huge player in shoulder mobility. Within the level two workshop, when we get specific with our corrective exercises, we show a very quick range of motion for the neck, looking for restriction or pain. And if we find a neck issue, you refer out to the appropriate professional to get that neck restriction or pain dealt with. The neck is the fuse box for the arm. Easiest way to put it. If you've got a restriction up in the neck, it can easily impact what's going on down through the shoulder and arm. So the cervical spine can be huge part of a shoulder restriction. Maybe it's just soft tissue work. Maybe it's a more significant issue. Even though I'm an AT and have some clinical background, I don't mess with necks very much. I leave that to the people who mess with necks on a consistent basis and can help me address those things. But the neck can be just huge where a shoulder is concerned.
Did you say, so if they have a restriction but not necessarily pain, you'll leave that alone and refer out for that?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think necks are, in general, and this will sound over the top, but they're sensitive little structures. And, you know, you can have a restriction that's hiding something more significant within the neck. I've come to know over the last couple of years that I have a pretty narrow C5, C6. A lot of spurring and you know, stuff going on around there. And if I'm sloppy with my training or traveling a lot or sleeping in different beds with bad pillows, which I tend to do on a fairly consistent basis because traveling and teaching, I'll actually get weakness and issues down my left arm. So I'll get a tricep and some finger weakness as a result of this cervical thing. If I manage it well and I'm not dumb with my training or positioning when I'm traveling and sleeping, then I do fine. But this showed up first as a restriction in my left rotation cervically. So left rotation was like, hey, I can't turn as far. Well, actually, a fairly significant, thing going on in my neck that I needed to be aware of.
Right. Is there a tool or method that may be underutilized to improve shoulder health and upper body mobility?
Without a doubt. One of the things that I've been using over the past few years is Indian clubs. And, we were fortunate enough, Dr. Ed Thomas came down to the FMS office and several years ago, and showed us some Indian Club work. This led to a little product called Club Swinging Essentials that we did with Dr. Thomas. And we've been teaching basically a workshop a year on Indian Club swinging. And it's amazing. One of my clients here in Pittsburgh has been a physical therapist for about 30 years, and he started to integrate it into his practice with his patients. Even just some of the concepts and unloaded, quote, club swinging, and just amazed at the impact that it can have on upper body issues, general ballpark thing there. So Indian Club swinging would be a very underutilized tool, and I think there's probably some things that we can discuss there that as to why.
Yeah. So tell us why. I mean, what makes the tool unique? What's special about Indian Clubs? I know there's a big history. They've been around for a long time. Dr. Ed Thomas is one of the authorities. Actually, why don't you tell us about Dr. Ed Thomas as well, and then we'll get into the benefits of Indian Clubs.
Very fortunate. I've been very fortunate in my life to run into various mentors that have been just big impacts in my career, in my life.
Yes.
In 95, when I was a very wet behind the ears athletic trainer, Gray Cook comes walking into my training room. I made the decision to go to the kettlebell workshop and meet Pavel. Right. And Gray, actually 2004, when I was presenting at the NSCA conference with Michael Castrogiovanni, who was on the first kettlebell DVD that I did with me.
Right.
Dr. Ed Thomas was there, and he gave me a pair of Indian clubs, and he kind of had a brief introduction there. And then a few years later, there I am at FMS learning from Dr. Thomas again. And Dr. Thomas has a background both in physical education as the director of physical education for the state of Iowa, in military fitness. He's worked with the military for years in various capacities with their fitness programs. He's a wealth, an absolute wealth of knowledge from a physical education standpoint, from a military fitness standpoint, from he knows more about martial arts and yoga than he'll ever really let on that he knows, because he's an extremely humble and self-effacing guy.
Yes.
And I think for people that have been in the industry or been practicing something for a long time, Dr. Thomas will always joke that he looks at his something like club swinging and he's just disgusted every time he looks at it, because he sees the things that are missing. So, you know, we joke about that all the time. And I was introducing something at the first Indian Club workshop, and Dr. Thomas was there, and a little bit of a passing of the torch, you know, hey, you know, I'm going to be teaching this for Dr. Thomas. So I stand up there and I start doing something. And as a joke, I looked back at Dr. Thomas and I said, "How was that, Dr. Thomas?" And he goes, "Well, it wasn't horrible." I'm like, "Oh my gosh."
Nice.
He's just a tremendous guy. He's just an incredible wealth of knowledge. And this Indian Club thing has an incredible history.
Yes.
Over time, thousands of years of tradition, and we can pretty easily go back in our minds and think that you know, maybe the first weapon was something that somebody picked up to hit somebody over the head with.
Right.
And you know, Indian clubs are not a far cry from that. So they have a tremendous history. They're incredible for opening up an efficient, mobile, integrated upper body, and in the end, lower body as well, because you can integrate lower body patterns into your club swing. I'm sure somebody out there is thinking he's holding it with his toes and he's swinging clubs with his legs. No, it's just different stepping and lunging and squatting patterns that you can do while you're swinging clubs. So it's a really interesting tool, and I think for a lot of people, the Indian Club swinging that I teach, that Dr. Thomas teaches, is actually pretty light. It's 1 to 3 pound clubs, and Scott Sonnen has a club bell swing, which is a heavier system of club swinging with his club bells. Excellent. It's great stuff. It's just not what Dr. Thomas and I teach. We teach a form of lighter club swinging, and which is really good for speed, coordination, integration of the upper body. So it's a great it's a great tool.
What's the learning curve, and would you say that the movements are technical?
They're as technical as you want them to be. I would kind of start there. We're going to do a movement wrong about 1,000 times, but as long as we're on that journey, it's a journey worth taking and learning those movements. And you know, I'm the type of person that Dr. Thomas will show me something. I'll do it a few times in front of him. He'll laugh. I'll go away and do it on my own. And I'll come back and I'll have it. I've got to have a little time to practice and get things right in my own body and mind. there is a lot of precision that we look for. If you look back at some older the old gymnastics training systems, and I don't mean the competitive gymnastics that springs to mind when I say that. There's an physical training was developed on gymnastic models. These were models of physical education that came through the military, through the Greeks, tracing it all the way back. For Dr. Thomas, it was the Turnverein system, the Turners who came over to the U.S. from Germany, 1840s, I believe. And established training halls where they held on to their traditional methods, and the Indian Club was part of that system, and was actually in the Army PT manual up until the 1980s. Nobody knew how to use them, but it was in the manual till the 1980s, and so maybe we'll see it return here at some point, but the. You used to look for things like a progression, and not just in weight, but in learning a skill. What's the next skill? Progression, variety. Variety is not the mindless acts of variety that are practiced sometimes in fitness today, because you've adapted in 6 weeks and you have to go to something different. Variety was something that would help you to that next step in that progression curve in learning one of the club swinging movements or learning club swinging in general. Maybe I do need to, as part of the variety, maybe I do need to do a T-spine drill to open up my T-spine a little bit. Maybe I need a Bretzel. Maybe there's some sort of variety that I need to help me get better on that ramp of progression. And we used to look for precision. We've lost that a little bit in today's training, where sloppy seems to work. And granted, I've been sloppy. I just try to get less sloppy each time I do something. So it's always a progression, some sort of variety, and I'm looking for a precision. Some aspect of my form that needs to be improved.
So I'm going to ask you about your specific programming in just a minute, but I'm wondering if someone feels that they have quote unquote healthy shoulders, is Indian Club still something that they should consider?
Absolutely. It can be a moving meditation sort of thing. I used to joke that it was like my left hand belonged to somebody else's body. I'm so dominantly right-handed. Outside of being able to grab something with my grip strength, I didn't know really what to do with my left arm. Indian Clubs has really integrated my upper and lower body into a far more athletic form and ability. I can use my left arm effectively now. I can integrate upper and lower body movements. It's allowed me to become a better mover, a more skillful mover. And there's a benefit to the club swinging for the healthiest individual, as far as and take it from a performance standpoint, hand speed, coordination, things that athletes look for all the time, in general public. So yeah, there's always a reason to club swing, as far as I can tell.
Excellent. So now let me ask you about your programming. What's a typical session like for you? Maybe in terms of frequency per week, how long is a club swing session? Do you do it pre or post training? Maybe just talk a little bit about that, kind of the big picture there.
Really all over the board.
Okay.
I've done very simple training sessions where it's some club swinging movements and a couple of get-ups, and some club swinging movements and a couple of get-ups. And that's a real nice combo, stability, mobility, coordination, really neat stuff going on there. Sometimes I just pick the clubs up and treat it as an independent practice. I'm busy, but I want to get something done. Maybe I'm in between sessions. I don't want to get all sweaty and nasty. So I pick the clubs up. I turn clubs for 5-10 minutes, performing various movements, and work from there. And also various speeds. I think one of the mistakes people make with clubs is they pick them up and it is the whirling dervish. You know, everything's going all over the place as fast as they can move them.
Right.
I really like slow motion, working through and taking my time. And that's where I really work for that precision, in a slow motion effort to own the pattern, own the movement. Sometimes it is that, active recovery, in between exercises. Maybe I'm squatting and in between sets of squats, I throw in some Indian club movements. Or maybe I just want to cool down at the end of a workout and kind of center myself and relax, which sounds odd. Getting back into the clubs there at the end of a session. There's 5 basic movements that we look for. I'll do maybe, and some of them go right and then left side. So I'll do maybe 10 to 20 of each of those patterns. So I might end up doing 100 or so total reps over 5 different patterns, sometimes less. Sometimes it's just 10 of each and bada bing, bada bop, put the clubs down. So it's really, it's a tool that you can pick up, have a little fun with, put down. It's a tool that you could use as an individual training session. It really fits in a lot of different areas.
And it sounds like it doesn't take away from anything that you're doing, no matter what type of training.
No, I mean, I think the only time that you would run into that would be if you were doing really high rep club swinging, which will make your shoulders feel alive, let's say. That's probably, if you're going to have a club swing session like that, it's probably best to do that during a lower body, more of a lower body training day, where you're not going to double whammy the shoulders with all the club swing and the heavy pressing or something like that. That's really the only time that I would say, maybe you just want to, mix that a little differently. But again, I keep it to really treat club swinging as a practice that helps me with everything else that I want to do. I don't very often treat it as a quote workout.
Right. Brett, do you think it's something that, I wanted to ask you, is Olympic weightlifters, would it benefit weightlifters in your opinion?
Sure. Okay. Weightlifters, especially with the overhead lockout positions, can sometimes run into a little bit of stability issues because you're throwing that bar back just a little bit to keep it centered during a snatch or a jerk. Clubs can be a great way to just remind your shoulder of what it's like to be integrated and efficient and stable. So I think it could be a valuable tool there as well.
Excellent. And what do you recommend for people who are interested in this to get started? What's the first step?
There's the Club Swinging Essentials product, which is, I think, Perform Better carries that. And beyond that, Dr. Thomas and I will be teaching an Indian Club workshop July, it's either, I think it's 10, 11, or 11, 12, whatever that weekend is, in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area. You can go to dv8fitness.com, DV8, number 8, so dv8fitness.com, Phil Scarito's site, who's hosting. For more information on that, but that's coming up in July. And it's kind of one of those rare opportunities to pull Dr. Thomas out of his cave and make him do stuff in front of people. And just the opportunity to teach with him is really something that I look forward to.
Excellent. And I'll put a link to Phil's website in the show notes for this episode. So who should consider going to this course? And it's a 2-day course. Is that right?
It is. It is. Everyone should go. Now, while I think that's true, I think that trainers that are looking for something new to establish into their practice and have a fun tool for coordination and movement should look at this. Individuals who are looking for a healthy, integrated, mobile, efficient upper body, maybe martial artists, boxers, golfers, you know, people who are looking for hand speed and stable wrists that know what to do and that, like I said, that efficient, integrated, mobile upper body. I think it checks a lot of boxes for people, and it's a discipline that you can study for years. I turn clubs, and I'm similar to Dr. Thomas. I'll on rare occasions video myself and then delete the file immediately because I'm just disgusted with what I see, because I see little precision things that I need to work on. You know, it does not yeah. stop me from swinging clubs. I don't shy away from the journey. I'm just happy to be on the journey to using clubs better.
Right. Well, it sounds awesome. Sounds awesome.
That's fun.
And if I'm not mistaken, the last year's workshop was really well attended. I mean, big numbers for that workshop. I actually had a buddy that went to it, and he gave me a lot of great feedback about it. He said it was fantastic.
Awesome. So, awesome. Yeah. We had a good time. We had a very good time. It's we keep it light and happy. We're all laughing at ourselves for the things that we're doing. And it's a good time. It is a fun course to teach because of all the stuff that we get into.
Well, it sounds awesome. All right, Brett, we're going to wind down here. I have the Power 3 segment, and this is 3 rapid-fire questions for you. And then nice. We're going to close things down with my final question. So the first question in the Power 3 segment is, you've created several products now, several DVDs. I have 3 of them on my desk. I have Secrets of the Shoulder, I have Dynami, and the Kalosthenos product. So out of all the things that you've created, I'm curious, what's a product that you're most proud of and why?
Wow. Good grief. I mean, my opportunities to work with Gray have just been amazing. Dynami and Kalosthenos I'm gonna go with Kalosthenos. And I say that because when one of my relatives who had been through a very challenging time medically and physically, when he called me and said, "I want to get fit again," I said, "You're gonna have to trust me, and you're gonna have to spend just a little bit of money. I need you to go buy Kalosthenos, kettlebells from the ground up, and a 12-kilo kettlebell." And within 6 to 8 months, he had progressed to the 16, to the 24, and to the point where he was using some double kettlebell drills. I kind of feel that strongly about the product that I trust recommending it to my family and somebody that needed some pretty good help getting back up physically. So I'm going to go with Kalosthenos.
Excellent. Excellent product. Question number 2, what makes a coach a great coach?
Wow. Boy, there's so many different ways to take that because I've seen different coaches accomplish great things in different ways. I've seen coaches who held the people they worked with to this extremely high standard. They were very demanding, not in an abusive way, but in a way that the person they were working with knew there was a very clear expectation that some things weren't going to be good enough and that the goal was higher. I've seen coaches that were in the vein of the motivator. God, if you've ever had the chance to see Todd Durkin present and just become a ball of fire up on stage motivating people, it's really something that you should see. I guess those are two ends of the spectrum, right? You have coaches that are the motivator, who are dynamic, who really bring this passion out of people, and then you have coaches that are demanding, that are the tougher coaches. People hopefully will gravitate towards the one that works best for them as an individual. If your coach is making you miserable, it might not be you. It might be the coach. So I think in the end, both types of coaches care for the person that they're working for. They want their success. I think Martin Rooney, who does a lot of great stuff from a coaching and teaching perspective, has a quote that says something along the lines of, when you care more about your students' success than your success, you have become a coach. And I think that's probably a nice way to wrap that question, is that when the person you're working with cares more about your success than their own success, you're probably with the right person for that moment.
Question number three is, your favorite uncommon kettlebell exercise would be what?
Wow, there's so many. I think it would shock people. There's some really dynamic kettlebell drills. Jeff O'Connor and I did a product a while back called Kettlebells for Power Athletes, and we show some really dynamic kettlebell drills in that DVD. Different versions of jerks and split snatches, split cleans, and moving jerks, split jerks, cleans, snatches, not moving jerks, but split jerks and stuff like that, and moving snatches and really dynamic drills. And I think people get stuck with their feet in one place and they don't utilize the kettlebell as a more dynamic tool. Now, these are advanced, and I know everybody out there thinks they're advanced. These dynamic drills are based on these fundamentals, and you need to be really, really good with the fundamentals before you start getting dynamic. And so those would probably be I think those would be the uncommon drills that can have a lot of bang for buck. And it makes it, God, it makes it a lot of fun.
Well, that's what it's all about. Well, it's not all about fun, but I mean, you should be having fun, of course, and enjoying what you're doing. Absolutely. You know what? I'm going to throw in a fourth question into the Power Three, and this is on the fly here, but what's a book you've recommended the most to people?
Ooh, wow. That is really all over the board, because people come to me at various stages. I like knowing where somebody is. Maybe it's professionally, maybe it's the beginning trainer who truly is just starting out with their first couple of clients. And I actually really like Coach Boyle's Functional Strength Coach. I think he's on Functional Strength Coach 5 because he's always he is not afraid to progress. And that is an excellent recommendation for the beginning trainer. Because Coach Boyle does SAFE really well, and he lays out a structure that people can follow effectively. I'm always recommending something like the Checklist Manifesto or Why We Make Mistakes as mindset changers on why we use a standard operating procedure like the FMS.
That's good. That's good. So yeah. you gave us a couple of resources there. And actually, the Checklist Manifesto, that's one that I've heard a lot about, and I've never read that one. I love to read. I love to actually ask this question because I'm just a book nut. So the Checklist Manifesto is definitely one that I'll check out now. So thanks for sharing that great resource.
Absolutely.
So, Brett, where can people find you to connect online and learn more? Where do you recommend people go?
So I have a poorly maintained blog because I'm busy doing other things.
Right.
Applied Strength, APPLIED Strength.com. I have an Applied Strength, I think it's comma LLC page on the Book of Faces that I do a better job of keeping up with. And I post some research and try and keep that one on a very professional level. So Applied Strength, I think it's Applied Strength, LLC. Those are probably the two best places to check in on what I'm doing. I'm on the FMS forum all the time, or frequently, I shouldn't say all the time. And a little bit on the Strong First forum and at my workshops.
Excellent. And it is hard to keep up with all the forum activity because you could spend hours in that stuff.
And, it's amazing. When did email and forum posts become a full-time job?
Right. It gets overwhelming, absolutely. And, we didn't even mention, but for more information on the FMS, the Functional Movement Screen, functionalmovement.com is the resource there for people yes. that are interested in that. So the closing question is, what's your big advice or specific action you have for listeners after hearing our interview today?
This may be a longer closer than you planned on, but something that's been on my mind recently is as fitness professionals who are taking a variety of workshops, I'll finish a combo weekend, FMS level one, level two. And invariably somebody comes up to me at the end of the workshop and goes, okay, what's next? What's next is you go home and you apply this.
Yes.
You spend time utilizing this information so that you own it. I'd love for somebody to leave my workshop, go home and dive so deep into it and have such familiarity and command of the information that they could come back a year later and help teach the workshop, not have gone to five other workshops and now they have this soup in front of them, usually a muddy soup because they have all this information that's kind of conflicting or they don't know quite where to go with it. If you need X number of CEUs in a 3-year period, plan the next 3 years.
Right.
Plan the next 6 years. Know that you're going to go from step one to step two to step three and have an education plan. I'm applying for NSCA CEUs for the Indian Club workshop, so I'll get that sent in this week and try to make sure that that's approved for the NSCA CEUs. But have a plan for your continuing ed. I guess, A, do continuing ed, and B, have a plan for it. Know where you're going to go. And a lot of young trainers get into a hurry to learn it all. They're going to go to all the workshops. They're going to spend thousands, and they're going to end up with a muddy soup, and they actually don't know how to apply it.
Right.
And I'd love a little more planning in that standpoint and take time to know and not master because that's a lifetime pursuit. But dive deep into a particular subject. And I guess the final piece of advice there is don't be afraid to take a workshop, read a book, or talk to somebody who is diametrically opposed or sits on the vast end of the spectrum from you. Take a workshop in something you don't agree with.
Interesting. That's interesting advice.
Dive in. Find out. There's probably a nugget in there that will benefit you. And even if you end up not finding anything that you agree with, you'll understand the other side better.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, that is great advice. And I really... Love the advice of having an educational plan for the next 3 years. And that is just so awesome. And I know there's a lot of coaches and trainers that listen to the show. So hopefully a lot of people take action with that information, because that is just pure gold right there. It really is. So Brett, thank you so much. This has been a really great educational session. Learned a lot, and definitely hope to do this again down the line. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. I look forward to the next opportunity.
All right, guys. That is the interview with Brett Jones. Great insight. Lots of tips and advice there. I hope you enjoyed it. I will have links for things that we discussed in the show notes for this week's episode. I'll have links for the DVDs. So the ones that I mentioned are the ones that I have. They are really fantastic, and I highly recommend them. If you have interest in the workshop that Brett Jones and Dr. Ed Thomas are doing this summer, I'll have a link to that in the show notes so you can find out more information about that workshop as well. Also, don't forget to post your review in iTunes or Stitcher. There's one more week remaining in the contest where you can win a $50 gift card from Rogue Fitness. So if you like the show, please be sure to post in your review and then let me know which review is yours. And finally, I wanted to make sure to mention that if we haven't connected on Instagram, make sure that we connect over there as well if you're on Instagram. I'm a big fan of this tool, and it's a really great way to share visual information and connect on social media. So check out Ardella Training on Instagram. I'd love to connect with you over there if we haven't already. And that's going to do it for this week's episode. As always, take action with the information, apply what you learn, and I hope to see you next week on the Ardella Training Podcast. Thanks for listening, and take care, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Ardella Training Podcast. Go to ardellatraining.com right now to join Scott's tribe of passionate fitness enthusiasts. Get valuable updates and resources that will help you take it to the next level. Train strong. We'll catch you next time on the Ardella Training Podcast.